And you're here on the White Privilege Podcast. I'd like to say semi-annually or bi-weekly, but it's been sporadic, so apologies. But you're listening to the White Privilege Podcast. I'm your co-host, Very White Guy. And as always, I'm joined by Unruly Rev. You can find us at Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. And on iTunes and Stitcher, just search IR John White Privilege Podcast. But coming to you sporadically, I guess is the right answer. Rev, how you doing?
I'm all right. We got to go to the movies a little pre-Valentine's Day morning with my spouse this morning, so I'm feeling relaxed, and that's probably the only holiday we'll get together, so glad that happened.
Yeah, and you got to, it's not totally germane, but you got to see Rogue One, right?
Yeah.
The Resistance. Yeah. Man, and can you... this isn't the point of this show to talk about this in general, but like, it really cracked me up that like the alt-right folks were kind of pissed about Rogue One. It's like, wait a minute, you're mad that like all the white people are Nazi stormtroopers and like Darth Vader's like Hitler? What are you upset about? I don't get it. Yeah. Like, they thought it was like they thought the movie was really written about, like, how egotistical to think that Rogue One, which was probably in production for, I don't know, like 4 years, was written about the newly elected Mango Mussolini. In fact, I've been, I'll take Leslie Mack's term, 45. It's not quite as derogatory, not nearly as honorific, just 45. Leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the criticism, too, was just that the majority of the heroes, the protagonists in the film were not white. And we're not white male in particular. And so I think that was a big part of it, is just we were noticing that, and how just how amazing that film was on so many levels. It's going to take me days to kind of have it sink in. And I'm looking forward to being able to see it again now as part of the canon, to like watch it as part of it, watch the three before it, watch that, and then watch the four that come after it. So I'm excited to start integrating it and really thinking about it in a bigger breath of a way of what that meant in terms of spirituality, in terms of the Force, and how the connections between. So I'm just excited on a lot of levels to be able to keep watching it.
Yeah, in fact, we came home and again, I'm sure everyone, no, like, spoiler alert, it's been out for a couple of months, but it ends and the next chapter, Star Wars begins. Like the scene for, we came home and we're like, dude, put Star Wars on right now. We're like, dude, it's later. I was like, word for like minute for minute, they got right there. Anyway, they did a good job. Glad you got to see it.
Oh, yeah.
Excited. So on to lesser enjoyable things. I mean, this is the White Privilege Podcast. But so there's been a lot of executive orders, right? And I don't think you and I need to talk about even, you know, the bevy of them, and the, you know, the call it the Muslim ban, all sorts of things that are happening. There are a lot of people, a lot of voices, probably more important than, no disrespect, you and I talking about that. But one recent executive order that it hasn't gotten nearly as much press, nearly as much white support, I guess, behind it, or I guess white protest support, I should say, was the executive order that, I guess there's another way they call it, like the Police Lives Matter order. I think it had a number. I can't remember. They call it Pro-Law Enforcement and Anti-Crime Executive Order. And this is their language. This is literally whitehouse.gov. Today, the president signed three executive orders to fight crime, gangs, and drugs, restore law and order, and support the dedicated men and women of law enforcement. In the last year, there has been violence and threats against law enforcement officials. That's just an outright, maybe, I think, hyperbolic approach. But anyway, these attacks on police are attacks on all Americans. Inappropriate conflation. These executive orders recognize that the most important crime-fighting measure is to stand behind the officers who are on the front lines. The people who risk their lives every day to protect Americans need to know they are supported 100%. That is why this first executive order will place the government firmly on the side of federal, state, tribal, and local law enforcement. This will ensure the funding supports officers on the street, and anyone who tries to do them harm will be aggressively prosecuted. And pin in that now that Jeff Sessions is the attorney general, right? The second executive order will instruct the attorney general, Jeff Sessions, to form a task force to look at how crime can be reduced and public safety increased. The third executive order instructs the attorney general to form a separate task force to focus on destroying transnational crime organizations and drug cartels. These dangerous groups bring drugs and violence to once peaceful neighborhoods in the United States and around the world. They have fueled addiction and fatal overdoses. They will no longer operate with impunity in this country or this hemisphere. So, again, I just call it like the Police Lives Matter executive order. But, you know, anyone that is reading that between the lines, and I, you know, Leslie and I talked about this ad nauseum on our podcast, and just, you know, the next wave will be legislation that makes it harder and harder to protest, that makes protest action. You know, we saw some of this even before Tupe Fiasco took office. There was bills put forth, and they didn't get a lot of support, but they will now. But there was a bill put forth to make any arrest or protest on a public property, like a federal crime, any federal buildings arrested there are certain kind of crimes with minimum sentencing. You know, so we knew this was coming, but it just hasn't had a lot of protest backlash, right? I mean, black men and women and protesters I'm following were like, oh, Jesus, this is not good. But you look at the response to the Muslim ban, people went out to airports right away. There was kind of a wave of protest support from white folk that obviously hasn't – this executive order kind of came and went without a murmur from most folks, right?
Yeah. Well, and you know, speaking of the orders – or potential laws that were trying to be put in place. I just saw on Twitter here today that North Dakota HB 1203, which was basically the bill that allowed anyone to that hit a protester and killed them with their car, there would be no repercussions if you hit a protester and ran over them with your car. That bill in North Dakota, which is obviously it can't be anything other than directed at the Standing Rock protests, sure. Since in the timing of when it came up, right? There's no question what that's about. And that just failed, looks like today, which is really good news. And it may be a small flicker, but the fact that that was even proposed.
Yeah, that's my, wow, it was even someone put that in, that you could hit a protester, like, yeah, that's okay.
That you could kill a protester with your car and be completely absolved. So that the fact that that failed to become law is good. It's a good step in the right direction, but it's certainly not gonna. It's a little piece of solace in this wave of day after day after day. This kind of deluge of executive orders and messages and tweets and you know. Interviews that are making people that do expect to and have in the past and plan to go in the future to use their voice as part of democracy to show up and stand with others to say and to stand to, you know, really stand with others. You know, these things are trying to make that harder to do, and
yeah,
like you said, make them possibly even illegal. And that, like this bill in North Dakota, was certainly going to make it dangerous. It really just was an open season then on protesters of any kind.
Whew. Yeah, that'll be.
It's just the beginning.
Our second topic is a little bit more in depth on sort of, you know, taking sides and the sort of risk is real and what it means. But I guess somewhat related. So in our household, my wife and I have been talking. You know, in particular with this administration and the way things are going, and now this executive order, lamentably about gun ownership, right? And mm-hmm. I've never been a gun person. I'm not, you know, even now I'm not for guns. I'm not anti-gun. I'm not like, oh, they should ban all guns. I'm not one of those people like, you know, get rid of them. But I definitely think 100-round banana clips are unnecessary. And I think the AR-15 sporting rifle is really just an M16 with a slightly different name. And, you know, if you can modify it to put one of these positive reset, I don't know if you've ever seen this, a positive reset trigger. It allows you to shoot a semi-automatic in an almost fully automatic way. Like you just kind of hold your hand in a certain way and the recoil from the gun, like, so like when we have these things, I'm not for that, but I also am not saying get rid of all guns entirely. Right. So I'm somewhere in that middle. But I'm also a practical individual, you know, practicality wise, having a gun in the home increases all these different things. Having a gun is an escalation on its own. So I'm just sort of like, listen, I don't really want a gun in the house. But here my wife is saying, yeah, man, babe, I got to protect myself. I'm a black woman. I'm now, you know, more visible with safety pin box. And, you know, I get fucking death threats regularly. And I really couldn't dissuade her of the desire to protect herself. So my desire to not have a gun outweighed my thoughts of her need to protect herself up until recently. You know, now it's like, yeah, you know, it's like, fuck, I guess, you know, if you want a gun, like I can't really say no to you about that, you know? And so there's part of this executive order. I'm wondering, you know, it seems like a step, and it to me, not that it makes sense, but like the normalization of the alt-right, right? The sort of the normalization of the KKK, it almost has to happen in lockstep with the castigation of the other side, right? So the normalization of the alt-right means they're going to be castigating the, you know, call it the radical left, right? So really progressive folks are going to be, you're horrible, you're thinking this groupthink thing and, you know, identity politics and blah, 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 blah. So at some point, I do think these legislative measures are going to prevent folks from getting gun ownership, right? Like, I'm not saying that they don't want black people owning guns, but if a couple million black folk got guns overnight, gun laws would change really quickly, right?
Oh, immediately. And certain kinds of gun laws would change. It wouldn't go across the board that all gun laws would change, but about which kinds of people and who could own them, I can't imagine that it wouldn't change.
Yeah, so I feel I'm not obviously not black, so I can't speak on, you know, black folk owning guns, but I do think it's just, I can't believe that we're at a time where I'm thinking, gosh, I can't dissuade you from that desire or need. And secondarily, there seems to be a window that folks are trying to close on black activists owning guns.
Well, black activists and any marginalized people being able to become part of any kind of resistance or, you know, or protest movement. Just even the language on the White House page here, that, like you said, when you were kind of when you were reading it out, the conflation of things in the last year, this is the quote: in the last year, there has been violence and threats against law enforcement officials, period. Except that right now, if you actually look at facts, that the last few years, the last, you know, 2.5 years since Mike Brown's death, which really did kick off and changed the protest movement in ways, you know, of recent, it's really what kicked off the way that the movement looks right now in terms of protest and resistance, right? So in the last couple of years have been among the safest for law enforcement in decades and decades and decades. Yeah. And really I work with a number of law enforcement folks in part of the work that I do. And overwhelmingly the biggest threat numbers wise typically is vehicle incidents. It's not people showing up with a gun or a knife and attacking law enforcement. It is vehicle related incidents. So this idea that the violence and threats against law enforcement, well, to some degree that's part of what happens in the job, but numerically it has not increased. And so this statement, as part of just in the last year there has been violence and threats against law enforcement officials, okay, that doesn't say that there's been an increase. So it's just the way that this is phrased is really, boy, is it just like trying to stoke the fires, making it sound like there and even conflating attacks on police are attacks on all Americans. No, it's not. In fact, when on the rare occasion it does happen, it's typically not about a bigger purpose or means. And all Americans, the word that is missing in that sentence that is coded, that is conveniently left out, is these attacks on police are attacks on all white Americans.
Yeah, and yeah, the attacks, like even let's dissect the word attack. Like if you are to believe the police narrative, fucking everything's an attack. Like not believing their police report lock, stock, and barrel and swallowing it without any question is an attack. Like for real, like yeah, questioning them in any capacity is an attack. Like we, and again, I don't want to maybe it's a different time to talk about, but I'm in the safety pin box group, and there's different, obviously measurable, allyship and things that are done. And again, I'll just give a little plug. It's a wonderful, amazing group and product. And I, you know, I thought I was pretty far along the journey, and there were still things within the material that was like, man, that made me think, and activities that, that when I did, I was like, oh, you know, I could have done this on my own. It was all right there, but I didn't do it. And now that I am doing it, it's a little bit, you know, sort of different response and reaction to it. But, you know, somebody was in that little group talking about these sort of same things. And they think they went to a local law enforcement police. They have this weird language, like, you know, a gun was discharged and a bullet maybe did hit a person that was fired by one of our officers, you know? So they went to this like hearing, and there was a EMT ambulance and a, you know, police person that fired the gun. And they described just like night and day. Like the EMT person was like a normal witness, you know, yes and no, and kind of, you know, okay, and had a conversational tone. And the officer was just curt and almost just like came up with an attitude of like, I'm under attack on the stand, just describing the incident to the grand jury was like, you know, defensive in nature. So this attack on police, you know, I just, anything short of blind, you know, acquiescence is considered, in my opinion, attack by them. At least that's how it's framed, you know?
That's definitely how it's framed. And that's part of, I think that's some of this language that we're seeing right now is something that's just, it's fueling that narrative, you know? The most important crime fighting measure is to stand behind the officers who are on the front lines. They, you know, and moving into this next one's right. Around like conflating drug, you know, criminal organizations, drug cartels, all this.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting. And, you know, oh, and the Attorney General is going to form a task force to look at how crime can be reduced and public safety increased. So I have a friend that's a colleague of mine from other stuff, and we've worked together in different things. And he's actually a police chief of a small town, and they have there are a number of municipalities all around the country now that are making the choice to not incarcerate drug and alcohol drug addicted people, drug addicts and alcoholics, and instead, if these individuals come to the precinct and say they need help, these precincts are actually finding them beds in treatment facilities and getting them into treatment. And so this municipality that a friend of mine is connected with, the result of the last 6 months of them not arresting people that are drug addicts and instead finding and helping them find treatment has actually decreased crime in their community. So this idea of look at how crime can be reduced and public safety increased is not about locking more people up. They're actually finding that law enforcement wise, they're doing a better job by being allies to the community and actually showing up and helping where places are needed. And they've got measurable numbers on this.
Yeah.
And so drug use is going down. Other kinds of crime are going down. And people are getting help and lives are getting saved, which includes the safety of the officers is also increased as the safety of the rest of the community is increased.
Yeah, and none of that surprises me. You know, and I you read the executive order, and anytime I hear, you know, it almost sounded like war on drugs, right? It was like, you know, we're going to amp up the war on drugs. That just sounds like, you know, more imprisonment for brown and black people, more money to private industrial prison complex. But the notion of treatment over incarceration, you know, I'm a big advocate. I never think, in fact, empirical evidence shows that policing vices, you know, drug behavior, prostitution, kind of stuff, it's just like social behavior is not very effective. In fact, I don't think anything is very effectively mitigated by incarceration. It's just as a means of preventing. History shows it doesn't work. The death penalty doesn't reduce the number of people committing crimes, right? Like,
right.
Anyway.
Well, so some of the things that we've talked about, you know, other countries have figured this out and are working really strongly in terms of substance abuse and treating it very differently, not treating it as a crime, treating it as a health, a public health emergency. And So, you know, countries that are working on that have done really much better. And so, but the other piece that I've talked with this friend of mine about was, I said, so when did this become something that caught on in your community?
When the white people got in trouble.
Well, when white kids were dying.
Yeah, heroin was a scourge that needed to be stamped out. Right. Black tar heroin's the worst thing in the world. We got to arrest all these black people. Now that white Appalachian kids are crushing up OxyContin, whoa, we need treatment, you know?
Right. And I said flat out, you know, and this is a white person, and so I said, listen, you know, what's happened when people that look like us are dying in numbers?
Right.
And ones. Probably that got – so we had this conversation. I said, is that what's going on? He said, oh, absolutely. He said, and not just that, but when a couple of the kids that died were connected to more affluent and important people in the community, that changed it around. Now, it's one of those things where if that's what it took, that's what it took. And it's the help now is helping a much wider group of people than it was initially what it took to get over that threshold. But you know, there's no way around it. That's part of it. And now it's just a question of can it continue when it's going to start even helping more and more people? It's going to help more marginalized people. It's going to help LGBTQ people. It's going to help black people. It's going to help Hispanic people. Are you going to continue with the same fervor that you've had now that it's where it started?
You bring up an interesting sort of tangential side that anti-oppression efforts, all these things that you just mentioned, all these efforts, they're going to benefit white people first. Like, it's just a fundamental axiom of, you know, like Leslie was telling me, she went to, you know, one of her schools, and it's got a pretty diverse, much more diverse than my high school was, like, you know, actually like 15-20% students of color. And she's there talking about, you know, race and having some issues. And she ended with, like, you know, make no mistake, the work these people, these young women of color are doing here are going to benefit all of you white people. It's going to benefit this educational institution long before it benefits women of color that are here. And it's the same kind of thing. Like, okay, now that white kids are dying, we're going to have some efforts. And you know, you're right. It'll trickle down. It'll benefit people of color. But it's going to benefit white people first and foremost. Just like food stamps are, you know, the number one recipient of government aid are white people. Like, we like to really, like, shit on people of color for getting, you know, food stamps, WIC, and, you know, EBT or whatever it is. White people are the number one recipient of that, right? Because we make up the biggest part of the population. People don't like to remember that, though.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that's where some of the work as white people and those of us that are looking at privilege and looking at deconstructing what we can of supremacy in some of these systems, where we need to then put our effort into is continuing fighting for and standing up for and arguing for these programs to stay part of municipalities and wherever we are, keep fighting for them when it's not just helping us first.
Yeah, I don't know what happened with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare conflation there, but watching like honest to goodness, like heart of the red country people that were like, fucking, I hate Obamacare, going to town hall meetings telling, like, you better keep Affordable Care Act. Like, it's like, whoa. And I don't know who or how that happened that you know, they worked so hard to peg it as Obamacare. Now that people think it's Obamacare and they don't know that it's the same thing as ACA, it's weird. But my family up until recently was on the Affordable Care Act. In fact, we are. My wife still has, you know, health care insurance. So the second topic, and it sort of leads into this, is sort of speaking out. And I put in kind of like, you know, risk is real, and this thing I've heard, virtue signaling. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it, but it's this weird thing that the alt-right, you know, individuals will use. So they'll say, oh, you know, very white guy, you're just virtue signaling. And it's sort of like the thinking or logic, I assume, ostensibly, is that there's going to be some sort of race war. And when that breaks out, you know, as a white person, I'm signaling that I'm a virtuous person. Like, I'm a good one. I'm on your side with the black folks. Don't kill me or something. That's their kind of, I don't use this word. They use it. They throw it at me often. But I was thinking about this sort of just, you know, speaking out, just being so, like, you and I, like, we work and navigate a white supremacist world as a white person that's speaking out against white supremacy while also simultaneously benefiting from our white skin privilege. And that's an odd kind of duality in reality. And I'm very fortunate. My employment is not one that is at risk right? My employer knows of my stance. In fact, disagrees, probably voted for Trump, but, you know, is the kind of person that if somebody called the office and said, you should fire, you know, Drew's talking about race, he'd be like, give him a raise. Like, he would do the exact opposite. Like, so I'm comfortable, right, in my employment, but I know a lot of other people aren't. There's realities of speaking out. And I feel like we're entering a period of time, especially because that executive action, it feels like we need more people to speak out, to drown out what's been left in the void, the Tea Party alt-right void. Their voices are taking up a lot of the air. But at the same time, speaking out does have some different consequences now, you know, maybe more real, you know, like, and again, this is not by any means, I wouldn't say like, oh my God, woe is me. But like I had a masseuse recommendation, and it was through Facebook, and they run their business on Facebook, and they connected with me on Facebook, and I messaged and I got their schedule. And about 48 hours later, I went back and I was blocked. It's like, you know, like, oh, okay, I guess they read my Facebook profile. And that's not a real risk. It's a masseur. There's other ones I can get. But, you know, what is sort of your thoughts, Rev? And I don't want to put you on the spot, but you've got employment in a couple different hierarchical organizations, one a ministerial and one a government entity. There's some realities of what you like literally can and can't say, right?
There is. And I'll have to say, I just, even as a minister, starting with some of the things that I've said from pulpits, right after in the year or so after Mike Brown died, was killed, you know, I was pretty vocal and continue to be pretty vocal about what happened. I'm here in St. Louis, so was connected to that and was on the street and part of things, and then went into congregations and spoke about it. And there was blowback in several congregations that I spoke pretty frankly about. And there was one congregation in particular that I've been made aware of where prominent members of that congregation told the minister that if I was going to be in the pulpit anymore, if I'd be invited into the pulpit anymore, that they would withhold their pledges for the year.
Wow.
So that's a pretty direct silence attempt to silence me and what I was saying. And attempting to keep that minister from choosing to have what words, because clearly if those kinds of things are happening, that's not just about silencing me. That's also about making sure that minister knows that these are not things that are going to be welcome here.
And we shouldn't tangent on this, but our faith is a democratic one, and there are communities where, you know, like presidents of that community are chiefs of police. Right? And they've got that community has a very different view than some of our other communities, you know? And I think I didn't know this until I, you know, started going to church and learning and speaking with folks like yourself, but, ministerial work at its core is still a job. You're still employed, and you're employed by the congregation. And, you know, I don't know, like if the congregation says, please lead us. And then you start leading them in a certain way that's more radical than they're comfortable with. You could be out of a job, right?
Yeah, we do have something. Unitarian Universalism does have something called, you know, freedom of the pulpit. That's part of the. That's a tenet that ministers have, freedom of the pulpit, which means that we cannot be dictated by the congregation, you know, about what we say, who we have. It ultimately comes down. The responsibility winds up, you know, falling on the shoulders of the called minister in terms of having to. Deal with repercussions as a result of whatever is said. So they're responsible for that for sure. But that's out there. Doesn't mean that folks won't do what they need to do or want to do by using democracy is one of our, is one of our principles, which means if people are upset about it, they can use their voice or their feet or their dollars to try to influence what's happening. If they don't like it, they can pick it up and move it somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, we had an issue at my former congregation where they, you know, the language they use is, we asked that minister to politely continue their journey elsewhere. I was like, that's a real ecumenical way of phrasing things. But and it wasn't over race. It was actually over Jesus. Like the minister was more Christian focused and this community was more you know, secular humanist in nature, you know, mystical almost. But nevertheless, it's, you know, so this speaking out risk is real. Like I said, on the one side, they're castigating the radical left. And on the alt-right side, the normalization is just staggering. They're asking to have the KKK removed from terror watch groups. Like Trump literally, so he got endorsed by the KKK and refused to kind of say that was a bad thing. Like, he refused, like, ah, you know, I don't really know. Yeah, whatever. He, like, he soft-shoed the KKK endorsement. And now he's asking them to not be on the terror watch list. You know, and we're seeing stories after stories of KKK literature, of flyers, things in like child daycare centers that are just, and the you know, I don't want to call it normalization, but these dog whistles, right? So they'll use things like white genocide, because that sounds a little bit, you know, oh, that sounds scary and bad, and you know, what are the, like, you can be, if you can be pro-black, why can't we be pro-white? You know, that sort of whole attitude, like, well, if there's an NAACP, how come there shouldn't be NWP? Like, why can't there be that? Like, that rhetoric, and even giving it an inch, I think is dangerous. But we're seeing a lot of it. This alt-right side, the KKK side, are like, it's like they were ready. You know, I know there are, you know, a bunch of weirdos in bathrobes at some level, but they were really waiting for this day, man.
And just even the language, and other people have criticized this much more eloquently than I'll be able to do, of even terming something alt-right as opposed to what it is, which is white supremacist. You know, that really acceptable language, like you said, normalizing language, pro-white, is not what it sounds like. It is, this is, you know, 1984 doublespeak. Alt-right is 1984 doublespeak. It is not what it sounds like. It sounds very innocent, and that we're just standing up for our folks, except that the undercurrent of what that means, and what historically that has been, is not just we're standing, it's not about I'm standing up for me, it's I'm gonna stomp on you to the every ability that I have, using everything I can for anybody that's not me. It's not lifting up, you know, being pro-black is about lifting up a people to be at the same, at an equal status. It's not about taking anybody else down. It's not about tearing anybody else down. It's about lifting up to an equal status. The pro-LGBT movement is not about tearing down straight people. It's about lifting up LGBT folks to the same status, an equal status with straight people and cis people. You know, that's what that is. It's totally different than pro-white. Is about making sure that nobody else gets to the status that white people are.
Yeah, you know, and the third piece we're going to talk about is sort of, you know, and I don't like the word woke, but I guess I don't know of any other shorthand definition. It's not my favorite term, but so, you know, newly woke folks and what people, you know, newly on the journey. And there was two different links that I'll put in the notes, but Helms has a racial identity model that I really like, and it's sort of just sort of the different ways that you can identify, and it's kind of like from white supremacist to, you know, abolitionist, right? And there's another one, Barnard Hess also has sort of this white predominant identities that that we as white people can have, or the predominant ways of being as a white person. And there's a lot of again, much better resources. Waking Up White was a book, and there's a couple of the resources about sort of this dynamic. But the thing that I was thinking about is how, you know, as an individual on my journey, I've kind of like gone from one end to the other and back and forth. Like, it's not a road that you travel from one end to the other, right? It's not binary, but you can encompass kind of two different spaces, and you can kind of take a step backwards, and you can do some things that are really kind of good, but then you can also uphold supremacy in other ways. And just sort of, you know, thinking about all the different ways that this stuff happens, and this thing about speaking out, and kind of, so, you know, maybe you can't do the Twitter hashtag thing because your work monitors this or that, but you can do something else. You can shift power and resources. Just, you know, as it becomes increasingly, I think it is more important to pick a side. You know, like, if you're neutral right now, you are actively choosing, you know, not just the side of the oppressor, but a really active oppressor, right? Being neutral now, I think, is like more so than any other point in our history. Like, I can't remember who said it, but someone was waxing philosophical about the halcyon days of W. You know, like, boy, I really miss the even-headedness of George W. Bush.
Well, and I got to say, I think at this point, neutrality will not save you. And it doesn't matter generally for wherever you sit, neutrality this time around is not going to save you.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And that's kind of what this whole virtue signaling thing is. Like, if you're neutral, you haven't, in their mind, virtue signaled. And But so I think I'll wrap this up by talking about the safety pin box. The way that they do their task, and I highly recommend folks just subscribe to the newsletter. You'll get the one sample task. There are other things you can get by being a part of the newsletter and the group. And then if you can't do that, you can donate to the Black Women Being Fund. There's a $25 e-ally box where you get the actual tasks, but not the physical box. But the way it's structured, each week and each task is really kind of neat. The first part is really internal work. So the first bit is like, you know what, where is my thinking and assumptions on this piece that we're working on? What's my internalized supremacist indoctrination? So you're working kind of on internal stuff. Then the second part is like, okay, what's some of the data? How is this in a sort of a bigger picture? How does this impact usually negatively Black folk? And then the third part is like, how do I take this locally? Where's the action? Okay, what can I actually go and do, you know, to take, I've internalized, done the work internally. I've understood this conceptually on a sort of a macro level. How am I going to now combat this on a micro level? So I think it's really brilliant. There, you know, each one is like that. And they had one a month ago that was about radical compassion, and there was different groups that folks were showing radical compassion for. And one of them was Black elderly. And this goes back to sort of like, you know, I don't want to say I consider myself pretty woke, but like the reality is I'm married to a Black liberation organizer on a national scale that, you know, as her white husband, it would not behoove me and her and our marriage for me to be real fuck ass. Like, I better be a little bit further along the journey than like the average guy. And that's all because of her. Like, I can say, hey, you know what? I'm thinking this thing and it's messed up and I know it's white supremacist. Why am I thinking this? And she can answer me in a loving way, right?
Well, and that's really key to it. Just you being married to a Black woman does not automatically put you in that category. You have to do your own work in that. And that, I think, is really important, because that's the nonsense that we see about, hey, I've got a Black girlfriend or a Black boyfriend. I can't be racist. Look at this. I'm fostering some biracial children. It's not a pass. Means that you actually have
more work.
The luxury of having somebody in your house that you can be accountable to, that gives a damn enough about you to not, to hopefully not let you just skate, but also to give you a little bit of leeway when you do mess up. You've got somebody right there that already cares about you.
Absolutely.
But that doesn't absolve you of it. It actually means you better step up and step up quick.
Yeah, you're hit on the head. It's a luxury. And I say all the time that it's not only not a pass, it's a requirement for you to work twice as hard, you know. And I get those folks in my mentions all the time. And I sometimes will crassly say, just because a Black woman touches your penis, does that mean you're not racist? You
know, that's right.
It doesn't absolve you of being a horrible person. But so the yep. Radical compassion for Black folk. Again, I thought, like I said, I was aware. So the internalized part, I think I was good on that. The macro level, I had a good understanding of where the intersection for elderly and Black folk are and what that means. But the third part, doing something locally about it, I didn't do anything, right? I could have done something, but I didn't do anything. So here's the safety pin box. I'm like, you know what? I think I'm going to do this. I'm like, it's here. It's a task. I'm going to actually do it. So my first comment is, doesn't matter where you are on the journey, you could always use a little bit of a refresher, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like Leslie said this on other, I've listened to her on other podcasts talk about safety pin box in this way. So I'll credit her with this language, but you know, we hire instructors for nutrition. We'll hire instructors for weightlifting. We'll hire instructors for SAT prep. We'll hire instructors for, like, you know, all kinds of shit, right? Like, businesses will have cultural sensitivity. Like, we know that there's, experts that we can hire and pay to help move us along in a quicker way. Why not on racial justice and understanding supremacy? Like, why is that such a foreign concept? Why? I know why, but you know, so like, this is like hiring a personal trainer, and like any personal trainer, you think you're pretty good, but the personal trainer says, hey, you know what? Let's go back and do this thing you thought you knew. And you go back like, man, I'm glad that trainer, you know, I thought I had my back in good shape, but they told me this exercise that I used to do and I'm going to do it again. And so that's how I felt about the safety pin box. Like, here's this thing. I could have done it. I didn't, but you know what? I'm going to go do it. So the interesting part, I don't think I've spoken to you about this. So I'm with a friend, which I thought was also kind of interesting. I was like, I'm going to ask another white person that's not married to a Black woman as far on the journey, but I'm going to see if they'll come with me and kind of do this thing. And they did, which was great. So this person asked me, wasn't this like, this is going to sound weird, but aren't we just walking into a place and asking to talk to some Black people? Because I said to my friend, I said, well, we want to provide some support, radical compassion, and through our understanding and where we're at, we know that we're not going to just show up with blankets and soup. We're going to go and say, hey, what are the needs? Can we, you know, maybe that's a light bill, maybe that's a ride, maybe that's, I don't know what it is, but what are the needs and can we support those? So this friend says, well, aren't we just going in to ask to talk to some black people? Won't that kind of be weird? And I was like, well, you know, on some level, you're right, but that's kind of our work. We have to figure that out. It's like a muscle. We're kind of like training it. We don't know. And that was where I blew it. So he asks me, isn't this weird? And guess what I just did? I thought about me. Well, how is it going to be weird for us and weird for us and weird for us? Guess what I didn't do? Think of how this would be weird for the person we go to talk to. And we ended up talking to a social worker who's at a, you know, there's different names for it. Call it Section 8, subsidized, you know, whatever it is. But it's a housing complex that I know has individuals of color and elderly individuals that I want to support. So we go in and we say that, and she just can't get over it. Like, but what? I don't understand. Why? And it was a good like 5 or 6 minutes where I finally said, well, listen, my wife started this thing. It's called Safety Pin Box and this one. And she's like, oh, okay, I get it. She really thought it was a prank. She was waiting for me to pull out a – she literally said to me, I just two white guys walking in and asking to help black elderly folks just is inconceivable to me. I was waiting for you to pull out a camera and say surprise. Like 10 minutes
oh,
in
and- – could have been a prank like, ha ha, you're on candid camera, funny, or that could be really dangerous right now.
Yeah, she had no idea what it could have been. Yeah.
You know?
And so the other, so that was one. So I was like, okay, next time I've got to have a little bit of a, I need to think about the other side of the equation, and I need to have my little elevator spiel, right? Hi, I'm Drew. I'm here. I'm working on this task for Safety and Box, and this is what I want to do, and this is why I want to do it. But the other thing that was kind of interesting is that they're a group home, and they've got a mixed demographic group of people, and her and I are discussing how I can provide this service, and she took, again, about 5 minutes, she sort of saying, dancing around the issue, and I finally sort of said, interrupted her, I said, I'm sorry, it sounds like what you're trying to say is that you have some white residents that hoard any opportunity regardless of whether they need it. She goes, that's it, exactly. And I was like, okay, got it. You know, if you put a sign up saying, you know, here's Drew willing to do this, I'm going to get the most vocal white people right away. Okay, so now what can we do? So we ended up having to identify a couple people, and then kind of put me in touch. And right now we're talking to their family members because they're on, they have to have family consent for me to be able to take somebody to dialysis or some other things that they need. But I thought, you know, takeaway, I don't care where you are in the journey. Don't care how, you know, woke you think you are. Safety Pin Box is like having a personal racial justice trainer. It really, their tagline is measurable, accountable allyship, and it's for real. And I'm not just bullshitting. I know she's my wife, and I'm biased, but it, I was kind of like, damn. I went into it thinking like, okay, I'm going to do this thing, and I left it like, man, I really was unprepared to do this thing.
Well, you know, the thing about coaches, about having a coach is, or a teacher or a trainer or however you or an instructor, however you think about it, if you've got kind of innate talent, I think about like being, like having athletic skill, right? And you're a kid and, you know, you're a great ball player, you play basketball or football or baseball, whatever it is, you know, and you're really good at it. Like you've got a natural talent for that. But then I think this happens with music too, with musicians, right? Instruments too. But then you get to a point where you get a coach, and the first thing the coach is going to do is break down your whatever you're doing. That's kind of your natural stance, right? You do this. This is how you throw. Well, they're going to break it down because what you've been doing is unconscious, and now to make it conscious, it totally changes it. And all of a sudden, it's like, wait a second. I used to know how to run. First, it was left, then it was right, then it was left and right. But now that's not working for me because they've interrupted the unconsciousness of it and made it conscious. So it's usually when you're learning with somebody that really is trying to step up your game, it's usually uncomfortable. It's usually painful. And you usually feel like what I thought I knew, I don't know anymore. And that's part of how we actually get better at something. So if folks are out there listening to this that are having that experience, maybe you're newly woke or you're getting to a new level or a new phase with it, you've decided to jump in with Safety Pin Box, which is like, it's the most, probably one of the most important things that we can do as white people right now is actually get involved with Safety Pin Box and really do it. And if that's happening to you and you're feeling like, okay, I thought I knew what I was doing, I really don't, maybe I really suck, oh no, not maybe, I actually really suck, and look at all these other things that I've done, and I'm terrible, all this stuff, guess what? That makes sense that that's the place that you're in right now. Don't get stuck and walk away because you're there.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's what we can do as white people. We can walk away when we get uncomfortable. And what we need to do is do that measurable, accountable piece where we stick through it. Because really, if you think about any other skill that you've had, like I said, whether it's musical or whether it's sports, you know, athletics, if you stick with that coach, they actually have a vision for you that's bigger than what you have for yourself. They can see where you might be able to support and be a bigger part of a bigger team, right? Because they can see, listen, you've got X, Y, and Z. This is some of the stuff that you'll do if you do the sample task, right, with like with mapping, of resource mapping and stuff. Listen, you've got reach and pull into A, B, C, D, E. We can see that this is going to make you a really potentially a good and valuable ally where you can make some difference in some people's lives, but only if you stick through that uncomfortable part of, you know, hey, listen, I know how to play piano, but now I thought I can't play chopsticks anymore. What's going on? Right, but if you stick with it and you really listen to that coach, you do what that coach says, even though it makes no logical sense to you, or you don't like it, or it feels like it's just too painful, man, this is the time for us to really to dig in, to sink in. Go ahead. You know what? You're not going to die of being uncomfortable.
You know, it might feel like it. And you know, the other thing you're talking about, this analogy with practice, is very appropriate, right? Because, like, nobody really likes to practice, but you have to do it. And what better way to practice? Like the other part you said, measurable, accountable, consistency, right? Having a coach and having a schedule once a month, I get my coaching supplies and stuff. It, you know, it makes perfect sense. And I'm with you in terms of, what we can do. It hits all. And again, I'm biased. You can complain all you want that this is a commercial for my wife's safety pin box. I get it, but it hits every point. You're literally moving dollars from white to black. You know, female freedom fighters, right? Like literally power and resources. You're doing internalized work that I'm telling you, you think you might have done, but you can do better. I can do better. Always can. That, you know, racial identity model, I'm back and forth here and there. You need that work. Make it every month, make it consistent. And I'm telling you, you're going to be better. And the world's going to be better. And things are going to start changing. I think it's, I hope that it grows and grows and grows. And I know every month when her and her partner get to literally give money to black femmes, black female activists, that she's on cloud nine that day. That's a good day, you know. And I've heard her, again, I'll give this credit to her, and she said this in, I think, maybe another podcast, but in talking to these women that are receiving this funds, almost every one of them had some sort of comment of, I don't think I deserve this. And it's just like, and they're out there with, like, you know, two jobs, holding down, you know, protests and actions and, you know, doing all these things, and yet still think, well, I don't deserve this. Yeah. So, but I'm with you. And I think maybe the segue into the next piece, there is a safety pin box subscription. Obviously, there's different ways you can subscribe, but there is a Ally backpack. So it's a Ally backpack. It's sort of a primer for folks not yet woke, newly woke. And there's going to be like six different video series that's coming out in March, but you can pre-order it now through, it's delivered on March 15th, but you can pre-order through, I think, the end of this month, February 28th, and you get some discount, like $15 off, 85 instead of 100. So if you're unsure, you're just listening to us, you not really know what to do, you think maybe safety bin box is something you might want to get into, the Ally backpack is a perfect way to do that. And one of the things that I always talk about in terms of, and again, I don't use the word ally, but us white folk, is fragility. You know, messing up, fucking up, we're going to do it. We're going to do it often. I'm going to do it again and again and again. So it's not being afraid of doing that, but how do we recover from it, right? And I think recovering from our failures is just absolutely critical. And it's probably the thing that once I learned to separate my white supremacist indoctrination and conditioning, and then the fuck ups that stem from that, from my actual, this is who I am, Drew identity. I can see it was like before that period of time when my fuck ups were me, where it was like, you're calling me a racist. I feel like I'm being racist. I'm a horrible hooded Klansman racist, versus, wait a minute, I did this thing. Jesus, it's messed up. But that isn't me. I am not my white supremacist conditioning. I can be better than that. So fragility and how to, like, you know, recover from it is critical, important. And I loved, I don't know if you have, are you able to read this post? Did you talk to the person? I don't want to.
I can't do it by name, because I didn't get permission. But this concept of, I can talk about concept. We've talked about this before as well, around folks that, white people who are getting woke, and for some people that was the election. For some people, it's some of the things that have happened as a result of the so-called Muslim ban, right? There's a lot of things, and there's going to be a lot of waves of, okay, I got it now. I'm going to take a stand. Now I see it. I can't believe I didn't see it before. And so, particularly for white people, if we're experiencing that, and now we're finding ourselves in situations, maybe they're protests, maybe they're community gatherings, right? Maybe it's a town hall, something like that. And you've got people of color in particular saying, marginalized folks, whatever, depending on what the situation is that you're in, saying, you know, all right, it's nice that you white people are here now. You just got woke, but you do realize that doesn't mean you're in charge, and nice going. It's nice to see you here, there, but we're not, you know, don't totally trust that you're going to keep showing up because this isn't your thing. So the concern that can come from that is that us white people can get really fragile when that happens, and we can get real upset. Hey, why, don't shame me for this. I'm here now, so why are you making me feel bad that I haven't been here the whole time? Come on, I'm here with you. I'm here with you now.
This
idea, can't we just move on from that and get on with it? And let's just do the work together, right? Let's not talk about anything else. I'm here now, so let's just move on with the past.
Tone policing. You're being divisive. Don't say it to me that way. That's being mean. All that nonsense.
Yeah. And this idea about, like, don't make me feel bad. Don't shame me for not getting this before. That's really a lot about telling people of color, telling black women, black men, LGBTQ folks, you know, Native American folks, just get over whatever the past was. You know, it's I'm good, number one. I'm good. So I'm here now. I'm a good white person. So don't make me feel bad about the history. So this thing about that I think we need to start paying attention to as white people is that showing up, that is good. It is important that we're here now, that we're paying attention, that we're getting woke. But no matter how much our getting woke and showing up is, it's not going to erase the past, our historical past, or even our personal past. Knowing that stuff, there's harm that's been done. We've done personally, whether we knew it or not, harm has been done, and it's been done in our name. And so recognizing that is always going to be part of the narrative. We don't get absolved, and that harm doesn't just get erased by the fact that we're showing up now.
And really, the showing up now is like, it's literally the least we can do, right? Yeah. Like the jokes that two white allies walk into a bar because it's set so low. It's like, people want the cookies for doing the basic minimal, like, oh, you're a minimally viably decent human being. That is not applause and claps on the back and thank yous. You know what I mean?
And our fragility then is the thing that gets triggered when that comes up, of somebody going, all right, yeah, you're here. You're not getting applause, so show up and show up and show up. And we're not going to pull any punches and pretend that the harm that's been done generationally for hundreds and hundreds of years, really, I mean, as a people, since we set foot on this continent, right, that cannot be undone by you showing up. So that's cool. Our side of that is then that we can't have our fragility triggered to the point where we're either going to walk away, or we're going to insist that they not bring, that this not be brought up. We're going to insist that we're okay. Don't you see me for the special individual that I am? That's the piece that we've really got to come to terms with. And this is really where I think we need our own where we do need probably white affinity spaces to be able to go and go, hey, listen, I got to work this out and I need to talk to somebody, but I'm not going to bring it up in that meeting because I know it's not appropriate there.
Yeah, I have a, you're part of my white accountability circle, and that might be the version of affinity space that, that you're referring to. And I absolutely recommend other white folks, you know, and I'm on Twitter, Very White Guy. You can connect with me. I'm happy to speak with other people. I've had conversations like this with many folks. And it absolutely is beholden on us to, and I said this to Leslie. I said, you know, I've got this thing and I don't want to burden you with it. I'm going to work it out. I'm going to call the Rev. I'm going to do something other than, you know, irritate you with my whiteness, you know?
And it's one thing for you to have, like you said, you've got really the advantage of having an in-home person
expert,
around that.
Yeah.
But boy, who's going to find a way, you know, you're in a space, you've got accountability, you've got this relationship, so forgiveness is likely to be on the menu. That's not the case for those of us that show up in group meetings.
No, you know, and not only is forgiveness likely on the menu, like this space where, and I know most white folk go through it, I went through it, where you're at that newly woke and you're thinking, Jesus, I can't believe I'm going to sleep at the wheel. Oh, for crying out loud, I've really been asleep at the wheel. I can see where I've messed up by just being completely oblivious. And you feel guilty. There's white guilt, that's an actual, you know, phase. If you don't go through it, I think, what, you know, why didn't you? Like, why haven't you been in this? But so I'm in that phase. I see white people a lot, and I did the same thing. Like, oh my God, I got to do something. I want to do something. I got to do this. I got to do that. And there's almost this, like, I'm personally going to solve and end white supremacy. You know what I mean? Like, I am now awake, and now that, you know, Very White Guy's here, like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to end supremacy. And in our personal household, it, like, I took that pretty far. You know, like far enough that, like, it was almost like, I don't quite what she did, but there was like a slow golf clap, like, you know, okay, Very White Drew, thank you, you're here now and you're not going to solve it. Can we work now? Can you, okay, thank you, white savior, we got it. You know what I mean? It was like, and so that whole fragile thing and being that way, it's real. The emotions are real. Don't take them into groups. Don't take them to black folk. You know, take them to Rev and me and other, you know, white folk on online spaces and sort that shit out. And hey, guess what? I know it still sounds like a plug, but Safety Bin Box has a subscribers group expressly for this kind of thing. And just again, you know, on a side note, the group rules of decorum and procedure, like how to operate within the group, are about the best I've ever seen in a Facebook group. I mean, I've seen multiple Facebook groups implode with just, like, you know, it gets too big and moderators start doing this or that, or, you know, however it implodes. I've seen, like, in my years on Facebook, a dozen of them implode. And this group rules, I think, will prevent that. I was like, wow, that's a really thorough and well thought out by women of color approach to operating in a group setting. Cool. But you had this phrase, and I really liked it, and I think it's perfect. The best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago. The second best time is now. And I think I've heard Leslie, and I don't know if it's attributed to her, but, you know, you're right. You could have been awoke sooner. You could have joined the revolution and the Black Liberation moment sooner. But whatever time you do join is the right time, right? So if you're here now, great. And time to get busy. So here's a piece. I don't even know how to even get into this conversation. I really feel like there's no way to, but, and I'm wondering what the actual question is, but so you were telling me about a train ride, and you were witnessing an interaction between a woman of color and a white dude, and it had some unusual kind of tones, and you couldn't tell, if I'm not mistaken, whether the woman of color was placating, like, please stop talking to me, or whether the woman of color was like, yeah, Trump is awesome, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know the exact dialogue, but so there was some exchange that you thought you could, I don't want to say correct, but you could interject in, but didn't know if it was appropriate or how, or if you should. Is that summated maybe or no?
Yeah, to some degree. So I was on a train, and it was a long train ride, not like a subway ride on this, you know, in Manhattan or anything, where a couple of stops and you're done. This was going to be many hours. And a seat ahead of me was, there was a black woman on in one set of seats, and then there was a white couple, an older you know, in their 70s, white couple right next to her, so a seat ahead of me and next to her. And they had struck up a conversation that was unfortunately, you know, loud enough that you couldn't pretend like it wasn't happening.
Right.
And it was a good exchange about train travel and about this and that, and pretty equal back and forth. And eventually, I don't remember, because I was really trying to tune in and out. I was just trying to do my own thing and put in headphones for a while and took them out. And at one point, I unplugged my headphones and I'm hearing now there's conversation. And it wasn't about the administration now or anything specifically, but it was about how people are coming together or not coming together, and how we all need to come together. And that at one point, this white man and his wife was actually just agreeing with everything he said, so she wasn't participating except to agree with him. So she didn't have her own kind of thought process going on. But at one point, the white guy said, you know, my ancestors came to this country as indentured servants, and they were slaves too. And now we all need to come together, white people and black people, because my people came here as indentured servants. And it was at that point that I really actually almost jumped up, except that the black woman who was sitting there was participating in the conversation, was not every indication, everything that I was hearing, she was not trying to get away from it. She wasn't trying to get them to stop. She was actively engaging and asking more questions and being invested in it. So my quandary was, do I step into this conversation that is not my conversation? And do I tell this guy, like, do I say, hey, listen, you know, you cannot make any kind of a, you cannot equate indentured servitude with chattel slavery. It is not the equivalent.
Yeah, and then there's so much more, right? Like the generational wealth building, you know, it goes on and on and on. So my question here is, and I think I'm getting it now, and I don't know if I've had a similar situation, but like, is it beholden upon a white person that's maybe has an understanding on the journey to educate at every moment, right? Because that's kind of, we hear that, like, hey, it's up to you, white people, talk to other white people, educate your white people, don't let, you know, cousin and uncle idiot say their stupid shit on Facebook unchecked, don't sit at the dinner table silent, like, you know, we're understanding of that need. But then where does the public decorum and appropriateness, whether it's a train, and then secondarily, and this is me, I have a very, and I admit that my hard line in this regard is a crutch, but my hard line is I just refuse to have any, I wouldn't, when there's a person of color involved, I feel like I'd be stepping on them, their authority, autonomy. I'd be making assumptions about them in some way. So I just don't. But again, that's a very blanket and convenient absolution. I don't have to do anything in any situation when there's a person of color there.
That's where I was really stuck. Right. If this had been a white couple talking to another white person, I would have jumped it. I would have had to.
Oh, I know you. You would have been real loud about that.
That's really where I got stuck, was if I step in, how have I now tried to become this white savior? So I'm saving this black woman and any other people around here from listening to this nonsense that this guy is saying. You know, how have I now tried to sweep in and taken her autonomy for engaging very willfully for at that point a couple of hours with this couple? Right. And that's really where I got stuck. And I was my head was going back and forth with this. And am I just disappearing here so that I don't have to be uncomfortable with now, you know, making myself very public in this way? Or if I do that, am I undercutting the will of this black woman who has very definitely made a choice to be in this conversation? And my choice was to finally have to just do what you just said and say, this woman is very much able and willing to make a different choice that she's not making. And so at this moment, this is not the time, at least to do it publicly. Now, maybe if we'd gotten off at the same stop, which we didn't, I could have talked to this couple and say, hey, you know, I just want to mention, this was bullshit what you were saying. That's a theological term. But at any rate, that's really where I got stuck, is what do I do? What do I do? I think I know what to do better when there's just white people involved, but now this is going across other places, and oh man.
I'm thinking, and I'm not there, I don't know, and that's the reality for us white folk is that, you know, you're talking a very micro, very, very small microcosm of like poof a racism, right? Like you're on a, you know, you're somewhere and like poof, you know, racism pops off. And I'll just again speak for me. The first natural inclination, the conditioned, the trained, cult-like indoctrination response is they didn't mean it like that. It wasn't mm-hmm. racist. Like there's an equivocation of the racism yep. that happens in a split second. Like this, these all run through my brain in a millionth of a second. Like they didn't mean it like that. It was, I've never seen it. It's not racist. All that stuff happens, right? So that, as that's happening, I'm now not acting. I'm sitting here waiting, poof of racism, you know, seconds go by. And so for me, in my life, I've tried to, when poof of racism happens, I've tried to stop the equivocation. I've tried to understand what could I do and what should I do and what's the right thing to do, all in a very quick span of time. And it's not easy. I probably fail like 92% of the time. I don't think I get, it's like when someone says something mean and you're in the car and you got the best comeback, like two blocks later, you're like, damn it, I should have said that when I was right there. Like that's me, like with poof of racism, like the right thing to say is like 8 seconds too late. And I'm getting better and better and better and better. And I don't know what I would have done in this scenario. I'm thinking the only possible maybe would have been to like politely say, you know, I'm sorry, ma'am, I don't mean to intrude, and then address the white person and say, I have to completely disagree. I think you're entirely wrong about this. Mm-hmm. You know? And I don't know if that still comes off as like, when you and I were talking about this, in my mind, I thought about when we were at General Assembly and we had a session on for white people about anti-blackness. Mm-hmm. And there was we had some black people that were there kind of like, you know, just in the room sort of like, you know, hey, what are you guys talking about? I want to see what's going on. And I don't want to say that this black person, maybe they were under some false assumptives based on maybe like internalized depression. And for, again, I hate the word woke, but for like lack of a better, you know, like, was I woker than this one individual black person on this one thing? You know, maybe, but whew, that ain't my ministry. Oh, my wife over here would be happy to talk to you. Like I use as a blanket. I only talk to other white people and about white people. It maybe is an excuse, you know, maybe that, cause privilege isn't just white. And I do that a lot. I narrowly define my discussion in terms of race, black, white, when most of the tools of the oppressor in regards to race are the same in regards to sexuality and, you know, heteropatriarchy, all the stuff is the similar tools. So I should do a better job of being able to talk more obtusely about privilege and less directly about black white racism in America, right? I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have done nothing. I probably would have sat and put my head, I would have turned the music up louder. I would have drowned him out probably, you know?
Well, that's the piece in what you're talking about, closing that gap of how quickly can you go through all the different scenarios where you're equivocating, where you're making sure, oh, no, that's not, can we make that a shorter gap? And I think this comes with what we were talking about just a few minutes ago about practice, right?
Yeah.
And kind of rehearsing that stuff and practicing it. When you practice it, you've got a better shot at it getting at having a better response. And that's part of not doing it perfectly all the time. You know, how many, you know, look at batting averages, right? How many, a great batting average means
400 is the best. Baseball. Ted Williams is the only player in the history to have bat over 400. Four out of 10. So he missed the ball 6 out of 10 times. And that's right. The best statistical ever in the world.
And how many hundreds and upon probably hundreds of thousands of practice swings did it take to be able to get there? And so that's, I think, where having these accountability groups, whether they're online or if you're lucky enough to be able to find folks in your community, doing stuff in person with people is going to be even, you know, probably a better place to do it. So where are we going to find those? And we've got to start cultivating those because we need to swing. We need to keep doing these swings. We need to keep practicing. We got to keep doing our scales, if you like music analogies better, because these are the basic skills. You know, this is the scales that we've got to practice to be able to start dismantling these pieces and really taking apart the system that has given us as white people unfair advantage.
Yeah.
Unfair advantage.
Yeah. You know, and just again, I like using my own self, my own journey. There's a period of time where I felt a desire and a need to offer more assistance to black folk, to be able to tip, you know, gratuity to black servers more, to do all these things. And I could see times and places where maybe there's a grocery store and there's a person struggling to put the baby and the groceries in the car, this or that. And I didn't know how to say, like, hey, can I help you? And I didn't know if it would come off weird. And I'm like, only, you know, offering this to black folk. And yeah, the first couple times it was kind of like, I didn't know what I was doing. I felt kind of strange and weird. And now it's just like, hey, you need any help? Can I help you with that? And it just, you know, it comes off much more naturally. Again, my own life. I wear a Black Lives Matter bracelet. Here you can see Julie. I wear it every single day. Yeah, there it is. And, I remember when I first had the bracelet and I had a pin, a few other things. I wasn't wearing it daily and consistently. And I remember the times I would think to wear it were kind of performative, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't be wearing it and I'd be like, oh, this black person's coming over. Let me get my Black Lives Matter bracelet. Like, not exactly like that, but pretty close, like tangentially, right? Like, I could really tell, like, you know what? This is weird. I'm thinking about doing this at the wrong, like, I'm not doing this consistently. So I didn't wear it. I was like, you know, every time I thought to wear it, I thought this is performative and I don't want to wear it now. So it took a little bit of, I had these like two or three instances where I was like, man, I should be wearing it. I'm not wearing it. And now I'm thinking of wearing it in a performative way. What's wrong with me? Until I finally just, I had it on my desk with my watch and my wallet and I put it on every single day. And now I just wear it and it's not performative. It's just on me. It's a part of my being. I just have it every day. Now I wear it every day. The opposite's happened. I forget I'm wearing it and people will be like, oh, I like your bracelet. I'm like, oh, let's have a conversation. But it wasn't, it didn't just happen. I had to like practice. I had to put some thought into it. I had to actually be consistent about it. And that's just not stupid. That's just something as small as wearing a bracelet. That's something as tiny as wearing a bracelet literally took some actual effort on my part to, like, you know, do it consistently, appropriately, and actively. So, you know, if you're wanting to be better, you want to be effective in the Black Liberation Movement, hire a coach. And I wouldn't say there's no better. There is no other coach. I don't know any other black women that are offering education on a monthly subscription basis, safety bin box. But yeah.
It's the thing that we white people have been asking for, right? We're like, tell us, what are we supposed to do? How can we do it? How should we do this? Because we know we want to be accountable.
Yeah.
But we don't, but then how do we do it if we're not supposed to ask? Well, guess what? They're taking care of this for us.
Yeah, I don't
it's
wanna,
actually exactly what we've been asking for.
This might be a little too much like VH1 Behind the Music, but behind the safety bin box, when it was created by Leslie and Marissa on our vacation, our actual wedding anniversary in Jamaica. And there was multiple conversations over multiple days. But there was one that was, you know, ancillarily related to this. And we had, I think maybe there was four or five black women, activists on this trip. And, we're all sitting around and I think each and every one of them opened up their email. Every single one had an email that was some version of, you know, I'm a white person. Here's a bunch of things I've done that make me good. Here's a bunch of black people that I think are related to you in some way so that you'll speak to me. Here, please help me for free. Really, every single email was like, and like page after page after page, it was basically the same thing. And it was like, Jesus Christ, like four different women from all over the country have different emails from different white people that are literally like a form letter of, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm so helpless. And here's why I'm a good person. And here's how I know you. And what can I do? It's like, you know, safety bin box.
There it is. There it is. The answer to our pleas.
Well,
so
I think
take advantage by actually, you know, forking over a couple of bucks and doing the right, and then doing the right thing, because you can pay the money to get the information, but no amount of money that you have is going to actually change you if you don't put into it what is being requested.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, for our General Assembly workshop, I'm deciding how personal to get in my own life, but I'll just say here, the work I've done on anti-oppression, in my own, just internal, my own, you know, first revolutions from within, the work I've done internally the last 3 years has made my life immeasurably better. You know, I've had you know, I've come to a place in my life where I've got not just acceptance, but an understanding that I didn't have 5 years ago that has just made my life so much better. So, as I said, this kind of work, it benefits white folk first and foremost. So, yes, you're subscribing to Safety Pin Box. Yes, you're shifting dollars to black, women. But you're also benefiting and really in a way that, you know, I would put this as more important than life coach, nutritional coach, job coach. You know, there's just the value on it can't be underestimated. But so a couple other things I want to mention. We've got the Teespring stores, which are back open, teespring.com/stores, Ferguson Response. That's where you can get the Black Lives or Greater Than White White Feelings. There's a Raise Better White People shirt, which now has spring colors, and you can buy a sticker, a few other things. That directly supports Leslie Mack, and you get a cool t-shirt, and believe you me, you will strike conversations with a t-shirt that says Raise Better White People. Like
that one, that I have a lot of t-shirts, and that one has gotten me the most.
Oh, yeah.
I've had the biggest conversations, and boy, does that piss people off. And all I'm saying is raise better white people.
I would say of all my movement t-shirts, that's the one that without fail, I get someone talking to me about it every time. If I wear it out, it doesn't matter. Someone's like, what do you mean by that? What do you mean raise better? You know, there's other ones. I the one that says even white people are sick of white people's bullshit. People be like, I don't like a swear word, but they won't say anything. They're like, yeah, we're bullshit. Like,
but the raise better white people, I've gotten that the real pissed off that I would profess anything along those lines. And then I've had other people go, yeah, so what are you doing about raising better white people? And I have to, and as a parent, that is exactly one of the reasons that for me that I wear that shirt and I take that to heart is because I am raising a couple of white people.
Oh, your kids are awesome.
And I wanted, but that's, you know what? It has to be intentional. We have to be intentional about this for ourselves and for the ones that are coming up behind us, because yeah. It's not going to happen naturally. Certainly not where we live. It's not happen naturally.
We have a friend. We're in Grand Rapids, and there's an area town that's super, super wealthy, and they live on the super, super wealthy lake and $1 million home, and they're, you know. They're 1%, like they're that kind of wealth. And, they've got a little child. He's 2 years old. And, he is like little Lord Fauntleroy. Honest to God, he would just grow up to the, I could see him being all the worst kind of white people, but we're in this kid's life like nobody's business. We're over there with like, Leslie's got like a, like when he was one, there was like a book called like My Little Activist and stuff. And he's getting, we had our other podcast, The Interracial John, had a sponsorship for Culture Chest, and they deliver books for kids. And, you know, right away we're sending him a subscription to that. And we're over there all the time making sure that he's not our white boy, but we're making sure he's raised a little bit better. Last piece, in terms of checking things out. So you got Safety Pin Box, the Ferguson Response, Teespring store, and then whiteprivilege.info. So I understand Safety Pin Box is a internal work, something you're working on. But we do got to go out and do external work, you know, grassroots community organizing, and whiteprivilege.info has, I think now over 200 different organizations listed by country and state. A lot of them are surge chapters. But these are groups that work with white folk, doing anti-oppression, anti-racism work. There's groups for LGBT and other just sort of anti-oppression work generally. But so go to whiteprivilege.info, find a group locally to you, get with some folks, have an accountability circle, get busy, do something, subscribe to Safety Pin Box if you can't, get the newsletter, get the sample task, join that group and just sort of engage with those folks. Do you have any other comments for the show before our sign-off, Rev?
No, I think this has been a big conversation today. Thank you.
You know, and I selfishly, this is for me. I know that I hope there are people that value and find this conversation informative, but this is for me to talk to you, and I appreciate it. And I know I've been less accessible, and things have been busy. And I think the last podcast was in November, so that's shame on us. But I hope to do this more consistently and regularly with you, and just love talking with you. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, here's our sign-off from the incomparable Feminisa Jones. Help, don't hinder. Support, don't supplant. Cooperate, don't co-opt. Solidarity, not charity. One person can make a difference. Your passion is a superpower. Well, until next time, hopefully it'll be less than 2 months. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.